the Catholic conscience, at the ballot box. Are Catholics planning to lean on their faith and church teaching when they vote this November? Results and analysis of our exclusive EWTN News and Real Clear Opinion Research political poll. Anger and protests erupt across Israel after Hamas murders six Israeli hostages who had survived more than 300 days in captivity. That anger largely directed at their own government. And Pope Francis is warmly greeted as he begins a four-nation visit to share the good news of Jesus Christ in Southeast Asia. EWTN News in Depth starts now.
Our political parties are made up of humans that are flawed, and so in their own way, both sides, I think, are trying to do their best for themselves and for the people they're trying to represent, and it's just trying to figure out, as a Catholic, where does my faith guide me?
We take the pulse of Catholic voters about what is important in the upcoming presidential election. We talk to Catholics about town, as well as reveal the results of an EWTN News national political poll of Catholic voters. Our exclusive political poll done in conjunction with Real Clear Opinion Research was in the field last week. Now we reveal those results, which many may find surprising. Our main takeaway, what was most important to Catholic voters did not look that different from the general, often non-religious population. Mark Irons has this EWTN News Election 2024 report.
The faith of voters is in the spotlight. Ahead of the November presidential election, voters who consider themselves Catholic are sharing insights into their spiritual lives and if they accept church teachings, including on the Eucharist. 52% believe the transformed bread and wine are the body and blood of Christ and not symbols. 32% say they are symbols, and 16% aren't sure. 43% said they attend Mass at least once a week. The results from an EWTN News and Real Clear Opinion Research poll. The poll highlights the differences among Catholic-identifying voters over faith and politics as well. 49% disapprove of the job President Joe Biden is doing, while 41% approve. And while the vast majority at 81% say they are very likely to vote in the upcoming election, a much smaller number, 28%, say they accept all the church's teachings and that is reflected in how they live their life.
I'm more sad than surprised that it's such a low number that was, like, fully embracing all the teachings of the church, but it's not necessarily a shock.
When the results came in this week from the EWTN national poll, we wanted some added perspective.
We spoke to Catholics who said their views about important societal issues and politics are formed by their Catholic faith, and embracing the sacramental life of the church helps guide them when they make those decisions.
Fundamentally, the faith is not something that's separate from life.
If you're truly living your faith, that's not just the hour you spend in Mass on Sunday. That's from the moment you wake up to the moment you go to bed, how you live your life, how you interact with the people around you.
I spoke to individuals who identified as practicing Catholics and said they embrace the teachings of the church and also bring their faith into the voting booth with them.
It's very important to me to form my conscience according to what the church teaches.
Dawn Eden Goldstein is a Catholic theologian, author, and recent canon law graduate. She has been a controversial figure on social media, offering critical assessments of Catholic organizations she views as too conservative, and some have criticized her for advocacy of gender ideology. We also spoke to Gregory Warner, a PhD student at the John Paul II Institute for Studies on Marriage and Family at the Catholic University of America. Both of them aren't thrilled about either of the two major party nominees.
I don't really like any of the options on hand today in our politics.
I plan to unhappily vote for Kamala Harris.
If I had to lean one or the other, I'd begrudgingly go Trump.
In our national poll, 50% of Catholic voters said at this time they would vote for Kamala Harris, 43% for Donald Trump, and 6% were undecided. When asked what one issue is most important in deciding your vote this November, 51% said the economy, 13% border security and immigration, and 10% said abortion. Regarding abortion, Catholic Church teaching clearly states human life must be respected and protected absolutely from the moment of conception. And for Warner, the Democratic Party gives him reason to be concerned about the rights of unborn children. He mentioned Harris pushing a pro-abortion stance. She has the backing of major abortion provider Planned Parenthood, and she wants to restore Roe v. Wade and a so-called right to abortion at the federal level.
The Democratic Party is just solidly anti-life, I'd say, in its abortion stance at least.
And on border security, even though Warner believes Trump's rhetoric towards immigrants is often mean-spirited,
it is still a real issue that has to be dealt with in some way. And I think it seems like the current regime hasn't really been able to do that in an adequate way.
Meanwhile, citing the insurrection on January 6th, 2021, when then-President Trump's supporters stormed the U.S. Capitol building after he spoke at a nearby rally, Goldstein sees the former president as a threat to democracy. She also believes Republicans haven't shown a commitment to protecting and supporting unborn children or their mothers. This summer, the Republican Party removed some of the pro-life language in the party's platform, and following a Supreme Court decision, President Trump also said he won't block access to the abortion pill.
We pro-lifers find ourselves in an impossible situation with this election.
Though she's opposed to Harris's views on abortion as well, Goldstein is also concerned with Trump recently saying he'd provide government-funded or mandated IVF, a treatment which is contrary to Catholic teaching.
Embryos are made, manufactured, so to speak, and as a product of that process, often killed. Guess what? There is no right to have your own child by any means necessary when those means are destructive of human life.
On the other end of the life spectrum, Catholic voters were asked if they were in favor of the death penalty for a person convicted of murder. 56% said they favor it, 23% oppose it, and 21% are unsure. The results could show a rejection or lack of understanding of church teaching on the subject.
I'm from a part of the country where I know most Catholics are in favor of the death penalty. In spite of what the church has been promulgating and teaching.
Blake Thompson, a seminarian in the Diocese of Fort Worth, Texas, says both priest and laity have a responsibility to live and share the faith.
So it's dialogue and it's awareness. It's continued catechesis.
And when it comes to all questions about faith and politics, Thompson leaves Catholic voters with one more question to consider.
When you ask yourself, who are you and what are you in relation to the community, to the world, is being Catholic the first thing that comes to mind, or is it your political view?
Mark Irons, EWTN News in Depth.
To shed more insight into what we've learned about Catholic voters from this EWTN News and Real Clear opinion research survey, we're joined by Susan Crabtree, a political correspondent for Real Clear Politics, and Professor Ryan Burge, one of the country's leading data analysts on religion and politics. He's an associate professor of political science at Eastern Illinois University and runs the popular Graphs About Religion website. Thank you both for being here. I have a big picture question I'd like to address on the front end. Based on these poll results, does the Catholic voter look any different than the average American voter? Ryan, I'll go to you first.
Yeah, I've always said a really good barometer for where the American public is, generally speaking, is where the Catholic vote is, generally speaking. Their vote tends to look like the overall popular vote in the entire country. And I'll say, by looking at this poll right now, it feels very good if you're a Democrat.
And Susan, what are your thoughts on that? Does the Catholic voter look different than the average American?
Well, I think it's evolved over time. It looks more like the average American now. But back in the 1960s, when you had JFK running and he was the first Catholic president to run, there was an 80% swing in favor of where Catholic votes in his favor. And now, actually, it's more reflective of the average American voter. Mm. So we've seen that evolve over time.
That's some good insight. Ryan, abortion is a top issue for 10% of the Catholics surveyed here. Can that number significantly affect the election?
So I think abortion is one of those topics that we like to talk a lot about. But if you actually look at what voters care about, and you see this in poll after poll after poll, culture war issues like same-sex marriage, like abortion, like transgender, those are issues that we like to talk about a lot. But when you ask voters what they care about the most, it almost always comes back to the economy, the economy, the economy. Mm-hmm. And in this poll, it's clear over half of all voters said that was their number one issue. And the number two issue was immigration, which does seem in some ways to be linked to the economy. And you've got to get below 10% to get one of these culture war issues. Do I think it matters on the margins? I absolutely do. For some voters, they're single issue voters on the issue of life. But I think for the vast majority of voters, they look at their pocketbook, they look at their checking account, they look at how they're getting by, and they make their vote based on what their economic conditions are, not necessarily issues about same-sex marriage or abortion. Mm.
Susan, looking at foreign policy, 41% of Catholics regard Israel's response to Hamas's October 7th attack as somewhat or completely acceptable. Which political party's stance on the Israel-Hamas war bodes better than for gaining Catholic support?
Well, I didn't look at that question on foreign policy. I'm more focused on the big picture. And it strikes me what Ryan just said, that even though the Catholic voters care about the economy the most, the survey showed that the economy is a top issue for Catholic voters nationwide at 51%. They are still leaning more towards Kamala Harris. And in that capacity, it's interesting because most polls show that most Americans support Donald Trump to handle the economy much better than Kamala Harris. And those numbers don't reflect that in terms of overall support. So you have, you know, the economy is the top issue for Catholic voters, and border and security and immigration is at 13% among Catholic voters. And the foreign policy doesn't even rank in the top four or five issues.
Hmm. Ryan, one survey finding that stood out to me was the fact that female Catholic voters support Harris over Trump 56 to 37%. Were you surprised by that disparity? And can you shed some insight as to why that might be?
Yeah, so the gender gap is one of the most well-studied and most understood part of American politics, which is that women tend to lean toward the Democrats and Republicans tend to lean toward Republicans. I think what's so fascinating is how big the gender gap is in this poll. Female Catholics are incredibly supportive of Kamala Harris, almost 20 points she wins by. But then when you look at men, male Catholics, Donald Trump has a 6-point advantage amongst male Catholics. So we're seeing a growing gender divide in America, especially when it comes to young people. Mm-hmm. Young women tend to be moving further and further to the left over time, and young men tend to be more in the middle of the road, if not moving slightly to the right over time. We're seeing that gender gap now in this data, too. So it seems like it's becoming a pervasive part of American politics.
Absolutely. Susan, looking at this poll, 19% of Catholic voters think China poses a severe threat to the U.S. Overall, just from your political reporting, how significant is a campaign's Chinese foreign policy for voters? And what do you think voters are looking out for there?
Well, we saw yesterday that's a big issue. It was going crazy on Twitter that there was this woman from the New York consul, or actually in the governor's office in New York, that was a foreign agent on behalf of China. And that attracted a lot of attention. For the first time in this campaign, China has become a big issue. But before that, I don't think that the foreign policy has ranked up in the top issues. People are focused domestically, as I said, first on the economy, with 51% of Catholic voters caring about that, and then on the border issues and health care, and then climate change ranking a little bit in there, and K-12 education coming in rounding out those top few issues that Catholic voters mm-hmm. care about. Mm-hmm. That's sort of reflective. I don't see that, even though the world is so in such turmoil these days, I don't see that reflected largely in our results at the top issues that people are caring about.
Ryan, we discussed already some of the culture war issues. Do you see the issue of transgenderism and Tim Walz's record affecting the election based on the way that the Catholic community sees this issue?
If you look at this poll and other polls, what you see is most Americans, the vast majority of Americans, do not support gender transition procedures or treatments for minors. That's a political loser for the Democrats. And Tim Walz, you know, signed a bill in Minnesota that was far out of step with what this sample looked like, the Catholic sample, but what Americans look like in totality. So I think he's actually giving the Republicans an easy way to attack him by calling him extreme or very liberal or very progressive on this issue, when the, you know, almost every religious group in America does not support gender transition treatment for minors. The only two groups that do are atheists and agnostics, and they're solidly Democrats. You're trying to win over white Catholics and Hispanic evangelicals and people sort of in the middle of the political spectrum. And the issue of transgender is one where the Republicans have a clear advantage over the Democrats. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering why we're not seeing the Republicans do more attacks on Tim Walz on this issue, because it seems like it's an open vector for attack for Tim Walz.
Susan, we're 2 months out about until Election Day. Can you put into perspective the opportunity there is at this point for either campaign to move the needle?
Well, I do think that there's entrenched opinions about both candidates. Certainly with Donald Trump, you have a hard time with his voters getting over the 49% range. We've seen that in poll and poll after poll with Real Clear Politics. But in terms of Catholic voters, there's a margin of undecideds. So you see that Trump is really... And the voters are supporting Kamala Harris by a slight margin. But when you include those sort of the undecideds and ask them to have a more of opinion about it, they actually lean more in favor of Kamala Harris than before. Mm-hmm. So I do think the undecideds are going to be those are the swing voters are going to be deciding this race. And so those are the ones that are up for grabs. And this next debate on September 10th. That we're looking forward to, that's going to be critical for both candidates, because a lot of people don't know how they feel about Kamala Harris. She's been vice president for the last few years, but they still, she's sort of a question mark in their mind about her.
Yeah, absolutely.
So we'll see how she works in this debate.
All eyes on that debate. Susan and Ryan, thank you for breaking this all down for us. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
We hear what Catholic voters think in the EWTN News Real Clear Opinion Research poll as the candidates are on the trail before next week's crucial presidential debate. The debate will be held next Tuesday, September 10th, beginning at 9 p.m. Eastern. It will last for 90 minutes. ABC News will host the debate at the Constitution Center in Philadelphia. There will be no audience, and the candidates' microphones will be muted when they are not speaking. This week, the candidates both focused on their economic pitches leading up to the debate on Thursday. Former President Donald Trump spoke to the Economic Club of New York, telling executives if elected, he would immediately issue a national emergency declaration to eliminate regulations and boost energy production. He said he would embrace cryptocurrencies, and he told the group he would appoint billionaire Elon Musk to head a commission to perform a financial audit of the federal government, slash government spending, and save, he said, trillions of dollars. In New Hampshire, Vice President Kamala Harris also focused on business and the economy. That's where she unveiled new proposals for small business owners, including a $50,000 tax incentive for startup expenses. She said making it easier for entrepreneurs to successfully open small businesses is an essential building block to communities across America. And this week, the Harris campaign launched what it is calling a Fighting for Reproductive Freedom bus tour, doubling down on putting abortion at the forefront of the election. The tour will go to more than 50 stops across the country and kicked off with Harris campaign surrogates near Palm Beach, Florida, just miles away from Mar-a-Lago. Florida is one of 10 states where voters will be going to the polls not only to select our next president, but also to vote on statewide abortion ballot initiatives. Next, we turn from presidential politics to papal outreach as Pope Francis travels the globe to extend the hand of faith and goodwill.
I'm Courtney Mares in Jakarta, Indonesia. When we come back, highlights from the first leg of Pope Francis's apostolic journey in Southeast Asia.
A deep dive into the Pope's most ambitious trip yet with our EWTN News correspondent on the road with the Holy Father.
Even though we don't have the resources to have a church yet, we do have a church in the sense that we have the community.
And later, a 10-year pastoral plan for Hispanic ministry in the U.S. to meet the needs of a growing Catholic population. Details coming up.
I don't know how to express it. I'm so happy and touched. I feel like I just want to cry. I'm so touched because where else can I see the Pope in person?
a joyous welcome in Southeast Asia for Pope Francis as he begins the longest and most ambitious trip of his 11-year pontificate. The Holy Father will have traveled more than 20,000 miles by the time his 11-day trip is completed. Pope Francis began his first full day of appearances on Wednesday in Indonesia, the world's most populous Muslim country. Children greeted the pontiff as he arrived to meet with Catholic clergy and nuns at the Jakarta Cathedral. Indonesia recognizes six religions. Just 3% of the population is Catholic. But the Pope's trip is seen as a reaffirmation of the Catholic Church's commitment to promoting religious harmony. In opening remarks earlier in the day at a welcoming ceremony at the official residence of the Indonesian president, Pope Francis encouraged the country's leaders to maintain that balance between cultures and religions and to respect human rights for all. Indonesia, the first of four nations on the Pope's itinerary. He has now journeyed to his second country, Papua New Guinea, where he will stay through the weekend. On Monday, he will travel to East Timor, a small nation with a majority Catholic population. Pope Francis will make his final stop in Singapore on September 11th. Our EWTN News colleague Courtney Mares is part of the coverage team traveling with Pope Francis. She is the Rome correspondent for Catholic News Agency. We catch up with her in Indonesia prior to the Pope's departure for Papua New Guinea. Courtney, thanks so much for joining us. As I mentioned, you are traveling alongside Pope Francis on this grueling trip. Can you just speak to the rigorous pace of this trip and how does Pope Francis seem to be holding up so far?
That's right. When you look at the length of this trip, it is staggering. Over the course of 11 days, the Pope is traveling more than 20,000 miles total on 11 flights across four countries in Southeast Asia. Now, you'd think that after a 13-hour overnight flight from Rome and a packed schedule full of public appearances, the Pope would be a bit tired. But I've been surprised to see that during the Pope's public appearances during his first week here in Asia, he's been full of energy. Mm. And you can tell he's really enjoying meeting with the local population. Now, it's important to mention that Pope Francis turns 88 years old in December, and he's been using a wheelchair throughout this week here in Asia. The Pope's also traveling with a full medical team of a doctor, two nurses, and all of his personal secretaries who are providing a bit of additional support for him on this long journey. Mm.
That is really interesting to know, but it sounds like his stamina is holding up. Courtney, Indonesia has the largest Muslim population in the world. So what does this papal visit mean to Indonesian Catholics this week?
There has been so much enthusiasm here in Indonesia, not just at the public events, but you also see many Indonesians lining the streets of Jakarta just to catch a glimpse of Pope Francis during his visit. You're right in mentioning that Catholics represent just a small minority of the population here, just 3% of the population. But it's important to keep in mind that Indonesia is a large country. So 3% of the population means that there's 8 million Catholics here. And many of the Catholics I've spoken with have expressed just such gratitude and said that they were touched by the fact that the Pope would make such a long journey to visit them at his age.
Mm. Can you just expand on that even a little bit further, Courtney? Because, again, Catholics are such a small part of the population, but the country is home to the world's largest Catholic seminary. So can you share more insight into the life of Indonesian Catholics today?
Most Catholics I've spoken with here have described the Catholic Church in Indonesia as vibrant and said the churches are absolutely packed on Sundays. Now, one Catholic I spoke to had an interesting story. He said that he personally knows many Indonesians who have converted from Islam to Catholicism, including his own father. He said that living in a Muslim-majority country, when he hears the call to prayer every day, he uses that as a daily reminder of faith, as a little reminder to pray the Angelus prayer.
Wow. Wow, that's a fascinating insight. And Courtney, the interreligious dynamic of this trip does stand out. Pope Francis met with the Grand Imam of the Istiqlal Mosque on Thursday. Tell us about that meeting.
Yes, interreligious dialogue has been an important theme of the Pope's trip to Indonesia, which is the largest Muslim country in the world. While in Jakarta, Pope Francis visited the largest mosque in Southeast Asia, where he signed a joint declaration with the Grand Imam of the mosque at an interfaith event. Now, this declaration contains a number of themes. It rejects religious-based violence, which is really significant, noting that Indonesia itself even struggles with, there have been incidents of religious violence against Christians in some parts of the country where there are religious tensions. The declaration also stresses the importance of interreligious dialogue, human dignity, and protecting the environment.
Those are all important themes. Courtney, the stadium mass with Pope Francis was expected to be a highlight of the Indonesian leg of this trip. You were there on Thursday. What stood out to you, and do we know how many people were in attendance?
Let me tell you, the atmosphere inside the Pope Stadium Mass in Jakarta was absolutely electric. Now, there was not only one stadium, but two stadiums. In the first main stadium, there were more than 60,000 enthusiastic Catholics who were chanting and cheering as the Pope arrived. But then next door, there was a second stadium that also had tens of thousands of Catholics. I learned from Indonesian authorities that there were more than 100,000 Catholics present at this mass. So it was really something to behold.
Absolutely. Courtney, we have just under a minute left, but in our final moments together, what do you expect will stand out in the coming days? And what should our viewers keep their eyes out for as Pope Francis continues his tour through Southeast Asia?
This weekend, Pope Francis will be in Papua New Guinea, where the Pope will meet with local Catholics who minister in the capital city of Port Moresby with street children and the disabled. And so that will be an important meeting. But particularly interesting, after that, the Pope is heading off to a remote jungle outpost of Papua New Guinea, where he will meet with some Argentine missionaries who minister there. Mm. So that will be something really unique to behold. And after Papua New Guinea, the Pope is off to East Timor and then Singapore.
Wow. Well, we are just so grateful for your work, and be assured of our prayers for your travels as well. Courtney Marez, thank you so much.
Thank you, Catherine.
We will check in again with Courtney next week at this time as she continues to report from the papal journey.
Now I need you to help us stay strong, and I need you to help us survive.
An American Israeli mother mourns for her son found dead after more than 300 days held captive by Hamas terrorists. His murder and that of five other hostages sparks massive protests in Israel against the Israeli prime minister. And yet again, a school year opens with a fatal mass shooting. The shooter, a 14-year-old at a high school near Atlanta. Headlines are next in the Week in Review.
The tragedy and grief over the Hamas murders of six hostages in Gaza tops the Week in Review. Last week, there was hope that a ceasefire deal was in the making to release some hostages held since the October 7th massacre in Israel. But hope turned to misery last weekend when six hostages were discovered shot to death. Rage has swept Israel, much of it directed at its own leader, who protesters say dragged his feet and blocked the deal. Massive protests erupted this week in Israel. Heartbreak, anguish, and anger over Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's failure to make a hostage release deal. Unprecedented numbers of anti-Netanyahu protesters poured into the streets across the country, demanding he do more. That as the country remains in shock over the murder of the six hostages, including Hirsch Goldberg Polin, whose parents' urgent cries for a hostage release have been heard around the world.
We last saw the parents of Israeli-American hostage Hirsch Goldberg Polin about 2 weeks ago at the National Democratic Convention.
Hirsch, if you can hear us, We love you. Stay strong. Survive.
Bring them home.
At this moment, no one could be sure, but we now know their only son, held captive at that point for 320 days, was still alive. Sadly, this past weekend, the crushing news arrived that Israeli soldiers found his body and those of five other hostages in a tunnel beneath the city of Rafah in southern Gaza. Autopsies reveal all six were executed at point-blank range just 2 to 3 days before. Five of them were taken from an Israeli music festival on October 7th, where hundreds were killed and dozens more kidnapped. The sixth was captured from a nearby farming community. Three in this hostage group were scheduled to be released during the first phase of an eventual ceasefire agreement, including Hirsch Goldberg Polin. According to a firsthand account by a friend who escaped, Hirsch had been badly wounded, his arm blown off from the elbow down, when he rushed to throw a grenade lobbed at them by militants out of a bunker where they were sheltering. Because of his parents' many brave and eloquent pleas for the hostages released, they met with Pope Francis, addressed the United Nations, and went to the White House. Hirsch's story had captured the world's attention. On their shirts, his parents wore the number of days he and others had been held captive.
Every single day until these people come home, I'm going to be wearing what day it is. So this is my new fashion statement.
We're living on another planet, so I don't know that we comprehend time the way that you do or normal people.
Thousands of people attended Hirsch's funeral on Monday in Jerusalem.
Finally, my sweet boy, finally, you're free. I will love you and I will miss you every single day for the rest of my life.
Along with masses of protesting Israelis, upset that more has not been done to free the hostages. Former U.S. Defense Secretary William Cohen blames Prime Minister Netanyahu for a failure to prioritize the hostages' release.
Oh, it's very frustrating. We all can feel the rage, the sadness, the grief of the Israelis who have lost their family and friends. But it doesn't seem that their protests are going to prove productive in the sense of changing anything that Prime Minister Netanyahu is going to do.
What has been Netanyahu's reluctance to prioritize the hostage release? What is the way forward now? To help us answer that question and many more aspects of these tragic developments in the Israeli-Hamas conflict, we are joined by Nathan Diamant. Nathan is the Executive Director of Public Policy for the Union of Orthodox Jewish Congregations of America, the nation's largest Orthodox Jewish umbrella organization. Nathan, thank you for being here. I first want to give you the opportunity to react to the devastating news that six Israeli hostages were found murdered in Gaza just days ago.
Thank you. I'm not quite sure whether to say it's a pleasure to be with you, because this is a terrible circumstance to be speaking with you. The entire Jewish community, not just the United States and Israel, but globally, has been on the edge since October 7th of last year. Mm-hmm. Still grappling with those who were killed on that day, those who were kidnapped on that day. And there's been constant and persistent advocacy by our organization and by, Jews across the country and the world to try to save these hostages. And when we all learned on Sunday after the Sabbath went out of the execution of Hirsch and the other five, it was really a devastating blow, because many of us had met and I met Hirsch's parents, Rachel and John, when I was in Israel just a week and a half after October 7th. And have been, in touch with them since, and trying to help with the advocacy since. And so it's been really tough.
Mm. And like you said, it does feel like the world is on edge right now. Following the murder of the hostages, the chief rabbi of the United Hebrew Congregations of the Commonwealth slammed Britain's decision to partially suspend its arms licenses to Israel amid the war. He said in part, quote, as Israel faces down the threat of Iran and its proxies, not just to its own people, but to all of us in the democratic West, this announcement feeds the falsehood that Israel is in breach of international humanitarian law, when in fact, it is going to extraordinary lengths to uphold it. Nathan, how significant is that statement from the chief rabbi?
Yeah, I mean, the chief rabbi in England doesn't typically get into the middle of politics in general and doesn't typically criticize the British government. So it is pretty remarkable. Mm. You know, he's really a religious leader of that community. And but it was shocking. I have family that lives in England, and I know it was shocking to them, not only in terms of the decision itself, but the timing was just unbelievable.
As we've been reporting, large protests continue in Israel as the country reels from the murders of these six hostages. Hostage families have released angry public statements accusing Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of blocking a deal, potentially sacrificing their loved ones for the sake of holding a strip of land along the Gaza-Egyptian border. Nathan, in your opinion, should Netanyahu be doing more now to free the remaining hostages?
You know, it's hard for me to assess that question. What is clear is that, I mean, first of all, I don't think any of us are in a position to second guess or question what the families of the hostage members are saying. It's unimaginable to put ourselves in their shoes. And, you know, I'm not going to second guess whatever they are saying about the government or anybody or anything else. They just want to get their loved ones home. There is a very open and public debate between the prime minister and his defense minister, Yoav Gallant, over this very question. And the prime minister just gave a press conference earlier this week in which he laid out basically saying getting the hostages out are, of course, a priority for him. But, you know, he has to balance that with the priority of making sure that Hamas cannot repeat such an attack, and he's saying that holding having the Israeli defense forces in the border area between Gaza and Egypt is crucial to that, because that's how Hamas smuggled in all their weapons to perpetrate October 7th in the first place. The defense minister and other senior leaders in the Israeli military establishment are saying, let's agree to pull out from that area, that border area, let's get the hostages out, and if we have to go back in, we'll go back in. And that's basically the debate that's going on very publicly among the Israeli leadership.
Nathan, this weekend marks 11 months since the start of the Israel-Hamas war. Is there more action you want to see from the Biden-Harris administration at this point, and have you been in communication with the Biden administration?
We have been and are in regular communication with the Biden administration. Look, you know, people, again, have to take a step back and remember that the party that started this war, the party that perpetrated these war crimes, the party that's holding these hostages is Hamas. And whatever criticism people want to level against the Israeli prime minister or the Israeli military, the Israeli government, you know, they should be leveling that criticism at Hamas and at the sponsors of Hamas, who are Iran, Qatar, and other extreme players in the Middle East region. And more pressure needs to be brought to bear upon Hamas, if that's possible, to get them to release the hostages. No democratic country would stand for what happened on October 7th being able to happen again. And Israel, you know, Israeli society as a whole is not willing to go back to what the status quo before October 7th was, which is, oh yeah, Hamas is still sitting in Gaza and they can smuggle in weapons and maybe they can attack us again. That's not what Israel is willing to return to.
We so appreciate your insight and your time. Thank you so much for joining us this week.
Sure.
The start of the school year in a small town near Atlanta, Georgia, is upended by the first deadly school shooting in the state in 25 years. Four people are dead, including two students and two teachers. The shooter is in custody, and on Thursday, his father was also arrested and charged. At least nine more victims were hospitalized after the 14-year-old male student opened fire in the school. An AR-15-style rifle was recovered from the scene. Appalachian High School in Winder, Georgia, was locked down before terrified students were evacuated outside to a nearby football field. The FBI says it was made aware a year ago of the shooter after anonymous tips about online threats to commit a school shooting. The local sheriff's office did interview him and his father, but said there was not enough evidence to take further action. The father reportedly told officers his son did not have unsupervised access to guns. On Wednesday at the school, when confronted by police and two school resource officers, the shooter immediately surrendered.
He is a 14-year-old student here at the high school. Again, he has been taken into custody. He will be charged with murder, and he will be tried as an adult.
The two students killed were both 14-year-olds, and the two adults were both math teachers. In a major twist in the case on Thursday, investigators arrested the boy's father and charged him with involuntary manslaughter and second-degree murder. They say the father bought the AR-style weapon for his son last year as a Christmas present. This after being questioned by police earlier in the year about guns in the home. An update now on a story we brought you earlier this summer. The Diocese of Paterson in New Jersey and five of its priests, whose legal status in the U.S. expires as soon as next spring, have sued the federal agencies overseeing immigration. The lawsuit centers on a sudden immigration rule change, which affects how the government processes green cards for religious workers and threatens the ability of thousands to continue to minister in the U.S. The plaintiffs claim this rule change will cause, quote, severe and substantial disruption to the lives and religious freedoms of the priests and the hundreds of thousands of Catholic faithful they serve. The Diocese of Paterson is the first diocese to bring this suit against the Department of State, Department of Homeland Security, and the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services. The Global Catholic Network is coming to Canada. On Saturday, the EWTN Family Celebration gathers EWTN viewers in Toronto for a day of prayer, community, and fun. Since 2005, this free event has served as an opportunity for viewers of EWTN to meet each other, along with their favorite hosts, friars, and authors. If you want to join the EWTN family for this day of celebration, you can find out more by going to EWTN.com/family celebration. It includes the schedule and other information you may need.
We have different people from different Spanish-speaking countries, but it's like very much like put together, very tight community, very family-like.
Exploring Catholic life for Hispanics in America. The results of a new bishop survey about ministering to the largest group of new parishioners in the U.S.
Meeting the needs of those in the pews and helping the Catholic Church expand. That was part of the mission of a recent U.S. bishop survey of parishes around the country examining their Hispanic Latino ministry. In a church with decreasing numbers, the enthusiasm and participation of Hispanic parishioners presents a bright light. Roselle Regis has this Catholic Life report.
My hope is that, you know, we be a thriving community, not only in first generation, but second and third generation, because it's part of our culture. The Spanish language and the Spanish culture is so full of the faith.
A recently conducted survey shows the Hispanic Catholic community in the U.S. is growing. In a first report of its kind, the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops surveyed dioceses and archdioceses across the nation about their Hispanic Latino ministry. The survey asked three questions: the number of parishes in each diocese, the number of parishes offering Mass in Spanish, and the number of parishes with a Hispanic Latino presence or ministry without a Mass celebrated in Spanish. The response rate was 100%. There are 16,279 parishes in the U.S., 4,479 parishes have masses in Spanish, and 2,760 parishes have Hispanic Latino presence or ministry, but no mass in Spanish.
If you put together those parishes that have the mass in Spanish already established, which is the sign that Hispanics are welcomed as a community in a parish, and those who have the presence, we are at 45%.
Aguilera Titus welcomed the results, but he said there is still more work to do. They found common obstacles dioceses face when engaging in Hispanic Latino ministry include the lack of bilingual priests or limited resources. This is the case at the St. Gabriel Catholic Mission in Manassas Park, Virginia, an extension of All Saints Catholic Church there.
We have like 20,000 parishioners or something like that, so it's a huge parish. And it's so big that we were already having, three Spanish masses, and that was not enough. We needed more space and more masses for Hispanics to come to Mass.
Oremos. Infunde, Señor, tu gracia en nuestros corazones.
That's when the St. Gabriel Mission was established. Since 2017, many Spanish-speaking ministries, groups, and services have been created to serve the needs of the community. The priest in charge is Father Guillermo Gonzalez, who says despite not having a physical church, the mission is bearing fruit.
And when I first came, that was one of the things that really struck me. I was like, these people, they have such a huge desire for the Lord and for Mass that they're willing to do that every Sunday. And, you know, if you come to Mass at Manassas Park Community Center, it's not a church, but it looks like a church.
The St. Gabriel Mission is located inside an office building and is open during the week for Mass, Adoration, and Confession. But every Sunday, hundreds gather for Mass inside a gymnasium at the Manassas Park Community Center.
We've been, for a long period of time, we were asking for a priest because it was really difficult for the families to participate in events that are not in Spanish-speaking language.
Sadie Reyes and her family transferred to St. Gabriel Mission, so her mother, who only spoke Spanish, would have more opportunities to participate.
It comforts us to be able to come to a community that we know we're going to be welcomed and received and loved and just help us grow together.
Sadie teaches faith formation classes at St. Gabriel Mission, along with Natalie Arden.
So always in the group, there's always a couple of kids that don't really speak English. I'm happy to be the one, like, to teach it and for them to feel safe and welcomed because there's somebody that can speak the same language as me. It feels like a big party, but God is at the middle of it, so it's like a safe space.
For Edmundo Reyes, Director of Communications for the Archdiocese of Detroit, engaging the Hispanic Latino community is about the exchanging of gifts.
We need to break away with this idea that Latinos are this group that we minister because they're in need, but that we welcome and invite so that exchange of gifts happens, and then we are more blessed by that because God wants to bless us through them.
The Archdiocese of Detroit has annual Hispanic youth, women's, and men's conferences. Reyes says in order to build great ministries, leaders should understand the Hispanic Latino community.
Latinos have profound faith in God's providence. That God will provide, that God will be with us, that we will have enough. The other concept or attribute or gift that they bring is a love for family, the sense of community, the authentic Marian devotion. And one thing that, you know, it's so evident, right? The hospitality and solidarity, right?
The USCCB hopes to continue to expand Hispanic ministry, such as those in the Diocese of Arlington, Virginia, and the Archdiocese of Detroit.
I am very hopeful, and I'm sure that in 10 years, you know, the number of parishes would have significantly increased. I think the number of vocations to the priesthood and religious life will increase. The number of Hispanic families engaged in Catholic education will increase. And that is what we want to see.
En el nombre del Padre.
Rosel Regis, EWTN News in Depth.
Amen.
To continue this conversation now on outreach to the growing Latino Catholic population in the U.S., we are joined by Pablo Kay, the editor-in-chief of Angelus News, a Catholic news source from the Archdiocese of Los Angeles, the nation's largest archdiocese and the most culturally diverse Catholic community. Pablo, thanks for being here. As I mentioned, the church in L.A. is rich in diversity. Can you speak to how that's a strength for the archdiocese and, frankly, a reflection of the Catholic Church today?
Sure. I think one interesting advantage that comes to mind is that, here in the Archdiocese of Los Angeles, the Mass is celebrated every week in nearly 40 languages. So what that means is that an immigrant, newly arrived, or a visitor from almost any part of the world can take part, can find a parish with Mass in their language. And I think that often makes the Catholic Church here in LA the first stop, or one of the first stops for new arrivals. And then, of course, I think it's always a benefit for anyone's faith when we can become familiar and even immersed in traditions or devotions from other cultures that we otherwise wouldn't have been, like for the Filipinos, Simbangabi, right before Christmas time, or Our Lady of Guadalupe, or Our Lady of Louvain for the Vietnamese, to name some examples.
Yeah. That's beautiful. The U.S. bishops this week released a new resource to help equip ministries with more information about Hispanic and Latino communities, and it includes information like population growth estimates, a map illustrating the percentage of Catholics who are Hispanic and Latino. I spoke earlier this week with Maria Del Mar Munez Vizoso, the U.S. bishop's secretary of cultural diversity in the church. She shared with me what she's found to be misconceptions that Americans can have about Hispanic Catholics. Take a listen.
One of the most, I think, widespread misconceptions that I found over the years is the fact that they tend to think that the Hispanic community is homogeneous. They're poor, they're all immigrant, some of them might be, the majority are documented. That, is a big misconception, because I actually, the Latino community is very, very diverse.
Pablo, do you have any thoughts on that? And are there other misconceptions people have of the Latino Catholic community?
Oh, I think what she said is absolutely true. And I think it's very important to keep in mind. I mean, when we talk about Latinos and Hispanics, I lived for many years in Texas growing up. And I mean, there are families that you can call Latino, Hispanic, that have been there for three or more generations in the United States. So they may not even speak Spanish anymore. Their children may not. And then, of course, as many people who study this stuff stress, Latinos in the U.S. are not a monolith. It's hard to just put them in one category. They come from many different countries, many nationalities, and those different countries can tend to live their faith differently. I'm sure, for example, a parish in Miami that's majority Cuban, Mass there might look very different from a Mexican-American parish here in, for example, in East L.A. Mm-hmm. So I think that's very important to keep in mind.
Absolutely. That's a great point. And Pablo, expanding on that then, what do you think are some practical ways the U.S. Church can better respond and accommodate to the growing Hispanic population? How does it go beyond adding a Spanish Mass to the schedule, for example?
Yeah, I think adding Spanish Masses sometimes is necessary in many cases. But I think many times even more important is really taking care of families, realizing that in this secularized society, immigrants, including from Latino, Hispanic backgrounds, lose the faith or are at risk of losing the faith much quicker. So I think it's important to help families transmit the faith. Also, I think it's, obviously when it comes to priests and seminarians, helping them to learn Spanish, to be ready to minister to those people. And then I think it's also encouraging parishes, whether they're Spanish speaking or English speaking, to go outside the parish to seek out opportunities, maybe organized by the diocese or different apostolates or movements that don't depend on language, right? This is what we ask for as Catholics, the Holy Spirit, which is capable of helping us kind of overcome the barriers of language, also of race, socioeconomic class, age, I think that's really important.
Absolutely. Pablo K., thank you for your time and for this great insight. Thank you.
Thank you, Catherine.
When we come back, a little bluegrass, a little folk music on a late summer holiday weekend. The festival's Catholic Mass is one of the highlights. We'll take you there right after this.
It may be the dog days of summer, but it's not too late to enjoy the warm weather and catch some live music. The Appaloosa Music Festival in Northern Virginia draws thousands of people for live folk and bluegrass music, food, and fun every Labor Day weekend. One of the biggest highlights of this music festival, the Sunday Mass, celebrated on the festival grounds right before the musicians take the stage. We bring you there in our Images of the Week. Of EWTN News in Depth. I'm Catherine Hadro. Next week, a report about the EWTN family celebration in Toronto. We hope to see some of you there in person. Until then, have a great week and God bless.